Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, I guess I should stand back if I'm going to use this. Good evening. My name is John Madden, and I'm president of the Vancouver Institute. This is the welcome to the last lecture of our 79th year in existence. This lecture will end the spring program. Now, I was talking to the two nice people at the desk who will accept your contributions earlier this evening. And one of them said, you know, it's always like this, that people wait until the end of the year, and if they like the lectures, then they make a contribution at the end of the year. So that's a little thought I could leave with you, but actually I can do better than that, because if you sign up now, then your membership will be good for next year. And that'll mean you'll get mailed a program well ahead of time, and all of those good things that go with it. This is my last time as your president making an introduction, and I think it's only appropriate, first of all, to mention what I believe has been an outstanding season, and I would like to take all the credit for that, but I cannot. The presidents come and go, but the program chairman, fortunately for us, has a degree of permanence which really allows this institute to work. And I'd like, first of all, to thank Peter Nemeth, who's chairman of the program committee. Peter, would you stand up, just in case there's... And Roseanne Rumley, who makes sure that everything happens on time, and Roseanne is here. And it's appropriate, too, to give our thanks to the University of British Columbia, and especially the Office of Continuing Studies and Community Relations, which makes all this possible for us. I should say that our speaker tonight, as many of you will know, is here as a Cecil and Ida Green visiting professor. He's already given one of his four talks, so he's well run in and oiled up and ready to go. This will be his second tonight, and if you really enjoy tonight's talk, you may then wish to join him again on Monday at 12:30 in Biosciences, where his topic will be the molecular basis of photoacclimation in unicellular algae, and again on Tuesday at 3:30, also in Biosciences, the molecular basis of iron limitation of phytoplankton photosynthesis in the ocean. Dr. Falkowski was born in 1951 and raised in New York City. He earned his bachelor's and master's degree from the City College of New York and his doctorate here from the University of British Columbia. After a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Rhode Island, he went to the Brookhaven National Laboratories in 1976 to join the staff of the newly formed Oceanographic Sciences Division. He received tenure in 1984 and served as head of the division from 1986 to 1991. In 1992, he received the John Simon Guggenheim Fellowship. His research interests include phytoplankton ecology, biophysical processes, biochemical cycles, and symbiosis. Since 1976, he's been a principal investigator under contract to the U.S. Department of Energy to study primary production and the fate of phytoplankton carbon off the east coast of the United States. He's worked extensively in the Atlantic Ocean and in the Red Sea. His latest research efforts were involved in the Ocean Margins Program and focused on examining the role of continental margins in the carbon economy of the Central Ocean basins. In support of Brookhaven's multidisciplinary oceanographic research program, he's developed and promoted an integration of scientific disciplines in oceanographic studies. He organized two Brookhaven symposia, one in 1980 on primary productivity in the sea, and one in 1991 on primary productivity and biogeochemical cycles in the sea. In addition, he served on numerous U.S. and foreign advisory panels and has chaired workshops to address the integration of molecular biological processes in ecosystems research. He's authored or co-authored over 100 papers in peer-reviewed journals and books, and has co-invented and patented a fluorosensing system, which is capable of measuring phytoplankton photosynthetic rates non-destructively and in real time. He's currently writing a book with John Raven on aquatic photosynthesis. Dr. Falkowski lives in Stony Brook, New York, with his wife and two daughters. As I've already mentioned, he's here with us tonight, thanks to the generosity of the Cecil and Ida Green lecture series. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Falkowski, who will speak on phytoplankton, oil futures, and global climate change. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John, and thank you very much, all of you, for inviting me. It's really a pleasure to be back to Vancouver. I haven't been here in many years, and I've had many fond memories of UBC and Vancouver and life in Canada, actually. So this is really a multi-dimensional trip for me, as well as being a great honor to be here. Tonight, I'd like to try to explain to you something about human behavior, something about natural behavior, and of course the role of what 70-odd% of the world's surface is doing in relation to our behavior and natural behavior. So I sort of initially titled my talk to obviously get you to come, Phytoplankton, Oil Futures, and Global Climate Change. And one might ask, obviously, what has each of those things got to do with the other? And hopefully when you leave here this evening, it'll be absolutely obvious. So let me introduce you to, first of all, a little bit about the oceans. The oceans occupy, as I said, about 70% of the Earth's surface. Thank you, Paul. They have an average depth on the order of about 3,800 meters, 3.8 kilometers. But there's a thin skin of the ocean, which is relatively warm or less salty and doesn't communicate very much with the deep ocean. And that skin is only about 75 meters deep on average. And ocean dynamics are determined to a large extent for the productivity of the ocean is determined by the thickness of that skin. The oceans circulate, the water moves, and the ocean depth sees the surface on the order of about once every 1,000 years or so. We call that a ventilation time. Now, the main role of the ocean in the climate of the Earth is to absorb heat. It is a great modifier of change in radiation. Those of us that live close to the ocean recognize that our environment is tempered by the thermal capacity of the ocean. In other words, it doesn't get often as extremely hot or as extremely cold when you live in a coastal environment compared to the interior of a continent. And the heat capacity of the first just 3 meters of the ocean is equal to the entire heat capacity of the atmosphere. What do I mean by that? It means that if you raise the ocean, for example, 1 degree centigrade, you'd only have to do that for the first 3 meters to achieve the same heating rate for the entire atmosphere of the world. The other major role of the ocean is in the absorption of carbon dioxide. It's one of the largest reservoirs of carbon dioxide. And the reason it absorbs carbon dioxide is because there is calcium in the ocean. There is a large amount of an ion which can make with calcium, with carbon dioxide, a salt, bicarbonate, and it's like a soda bottle in effect. So the ocean actually has a huge amount, a huge reservoir of carbon in it, 50 times that of the atmosphere. Now, within the ocean, of course, there are living things. We all appreciate that intuitively, but most of the living biomass of the ocean is invisible to the naked eye. And when one goes down to, for example, the beach here, you see sometimes in the summer it's a little green. And the green is due, of course, to pigments of plants, the small microscopic plants, the single-celled organism, which we call phytoplankton, collectively. They're algae. Now, plankton comes from the Greek to wander or drift, the same root as we use for the term planet. Phyto being, of course, having to do with how they make their life from solar radiation through photosynthesis, which I'll describe in a short period of time. Let me just introduce you to what some of these organisms look like. There are some very large cells, for example, like this diatom, which you can see these small bodies inside. Those are chloroplasts. They're beautifully ornate. This is made of silica. And the silica frustules are laid down in a very detailed and genetically prescribed way. This is another example of a different kind of diatom. This is another example of a totally different kind of cell. And you can see it's in a mucous membrane held together in these little packages. This is an example of a dinoflagellate. There are many, many, many different varieties of phytoplankton. Now, phytoplankton evolved in the world's ocean approximately 3.5 billion years ago. They were the originators of all the oxygen on Earth. The ocean was the source of oxygen. But phytoplankton didn't have a very simple linear path of evolutionary life. They came and they went, and they came again. And we can record, at least to some extent, or infer their comings and goings in evolutionary history in the sedimentary record. My colleague at Harvard, Andy Noel, for example, published a number of years ago, not very many, a little paper on just a small section of the sedimentary record going from the Precambrian era, which is denoted at about 560 million years ago. There was a change, and you can see the widths of the lines here are related to the numbers of species Andrew found in the sediments and the lineages in time, in millions of years. Looking for a pointer. There are times, for example, where it says O to S. Thank you. In this period, this is a period from between the Ordovician and the Silurian, two boundaries in the sedimentary record, which are commonly found. At about 436 million years ago is when we date it. You can see a mass extinction. There was another extinction here. Both extinctions correspond to huge ice ages that occurred over large portions of the Earth's surface at these times. So there were many species up to this point, and then there was a major extinction. And then there were many more species that occurred, and then another extinction. And then more species evolved, another extinction, and so on. And that has occurred way before there was life on Earth, on terrestrial, firm Earth. Okay? There was no life on terrestrial, firm Earth at this point. Now, this is a complicated slide, and it's not necessary to really look at it for the most part. All you need to know is from the very beginning of the Earth's history and the earliest portion of the diversification of phytoplankton through present time, there has been a continuous evolution of these organisms. Continuous. This hasn't stopped. It has come and it's gone, and it's coming again. And today, we record somewhere in the neighborhood of 18 major groups of such organisms, the phytoplankton, 18 major groups. Now, this slide shows all of the higher plants on Earth. There are many, many thousands of species. For example, all of the flowering plants comprise 240,000 recognized species, a huge number of species. They're all in one major class. To give you an idea of what a class is, you and I and dinosaurs and chickens are in the same class. We're all in the class Chordata. Okay? So these organisms, for example, here, are separated, the cyanobacteria and the chlorooxybacteria are arguably separated more distantly than you and I and a chicken. That is the diversity that has been permitted in these organisms over this period of time. It's a very diverse number of groups with relatively few comparatively recognized species. And that's because we have a difficult time determining often what really means a species for this group of organisms. Now, all of the organisms, to some extent, in every one of those groups, makes a living by converting light energy into power to fix carbon dioxide. Now, when I say the word fix, I mean that we take carbon dioxide, which was abundant on Earth's surface, at a concentration approximately 16 times that which we find today in the world approximately 3.5 billion years ago, and we make something called sugars. And in so doing, these organisms, which are distinctly different from bacteria now, in that they produce this poisonous gas, oxygen. Now, that gas comes from water. And there's a virtually limitless supply of water. So, over a period of approximately 500 million years, our world went from an anaerobic world, one which was completely devoid of oxygen, to a world which comprises an oxygen concentration of 21% by volume, which is the world in which we live. And as far as we know, that relatively high concentration of oxygen has been relatively steady for many hundreds of millions of years. The concentrations of CO2 have gone up and down quite a bit, but all of the oxygen that was originally produced came from this simple process of splitting water by the photosynthetic organisms in the ocean that simultaneously produced sugars or other organic matter. Now, of course, that was the main way in which life proceeded to evolve in the ocean. Organisms evolved which used the oxygen for respiration, like you and I do, and burn up that sugar to make CO2, which is what we're doing as we sit and breathe here. Now, I just want to very briefly describe to you the role of the oceans in this carbon-fixing process today and examine it in the geological past. This is a very, very large number. This is 10 to the 15th grams, is called a unit, is a petagram. It's an almost an unfathomable number. It's equal to 1 billion metric tons, 1 billion kilograms of material. Now, the total amount of CO2 that is converted to sugar every year by these marine phytoplankton is on the order of, and this is an uncertainty, between 25 and 50 of these petagrams or gigatons. Yet their plant biomass is a very, very small fraction of the amount of carbon that they fix. So every year, these organisms, every few days, are completely turning over in their biomass in the ocean. And it's quite obvious that they don't have a lot of biomass. When you fly with an airplane over the ocean, you don't see a lot of trees. On the other hand, the terrestrial world is characterized by organisms that have invested a lot in structure. Wood, for example. And so there's an awful lot of carbon that is locked up in those living organisms, and they fix on this order, 50 to 100 gigatons of carbon per year. And their turnover time is much, much longer, many, at least two orders of magnitude longer than that for the marine phytoplankton. The consequences being, as very little carbon is stored in marine plants, there's very large fluxes of carbon through the ocean with very little biomass to support that flux. And in general, most of that biomass is eaten every couple of days on that order. It turns over, it's just eaten by copepods, it's eaten by fish, and that is the fate. It doesn't accumulate in the ocean. It doesn't become something larger than it is. This is sideways, but it doesn't matter. If we look down through the upper 3 or 4 kilometers of the ocean surface, what you find is that the inorganic carbon concentration goes from a concentration that is at equilibrium with the atmosphere to one that increases with depth. In other words, the deeper ocean has more carbon dioxide than the surface ocean. The deeper ocean has more carbon dioxide than the surface ocean. This gradient in carbon dioxide is permitted only because the phytoplankton are fixing carbon dioxide and sinking to depth, or their products are sinking to depth and are remineralized, in other words, consumed and oxidized back to CO2 in the deep ocean. So this process of taking carbon dioxide, making an organic material, sinking to depth, and becoming reoxidized permits this gradient which would not otherwise exist. If these organisms did not exist in the world ocean today, we would have an equilibrium between the deep ocean and the atmosphere that would correspond to approximately this value of carbon dioxide. We would be living in a world with approximately 2.5 times the carbon dioxide concentration that we live in now. Now, why do we worry about carbon dioxide? I'll explain that to you in a little bit, because human beings are doing something to the carbon balance which wasn't done prior to the existence of human beings. And it's other than sitting in a room and respiring CO2 as living organisms. If we look around the world, even though there's very little carbon that is not eaten, and even though there's very little carbon that is not remineralized at depth, there is a little bit of carbon that is not eaten, and a little bit that is not remineralized at depth. Just a little bit. And over many thousands of years, millions of years, that carbon accumulates on continental shelves. And I've just shown this in black here. This is where there's large reservoirs of carbon. This is in the modern world ocean. Now, you know these organisms of phytoplankton and their carbon deposition in another way. You know them in the oil futures market. When you consume gasoline in your car, you're buying fossil phytoplankton. You're buying that sugar as oil that was formed hundreds of millions of years ago and deposited in the relic continental shelves of those primordial seas, which now become the Athabasca tar sands, Oklahoma, Siberia. Those are inland relic seas which accumulated phytoplankton carbon over many millions of years, much like the Black Sea is doing today. And that carbon underwent a process called diagenesis, and it was sequestered in pools deep in the ground, ultimately and buried by sediments, and it formed a fuel that we can oxidize. But instead of oxidizing it by breathing it, we oxidize it by burning it. Now, we make machines to burn it. So let me give you an example of what we contribute to the carbon economy of the atmosphere. When you drive your car and consume 1 gallon of gasoline, approximately, 5 pounds, 2.5 kilograms, on that order, of carbon, as carbon, that's like charcoal, is emitted out of the tail pipe of your car. That's a lot of carbon. If cars were horses and that was just falling on the street, we would have solved this problem of the fuel crisis a long time ago. But unfortunately, in some ways, it's a more insidious problem. It's invisible. It escapes as a gas that we don't see. It goes in the atmosphere. Now, I'm going to skip a little bit here because I want to learn from the past in order to understand the future. This concept of learning from the past in order to understand from the future was first taught to us in some ways formally by geologists. And perhaps one of the most erudite examples in the geological literature, and certainly one of the first, was written by Charles Lyell, who published a textbook called Principles of Geology in 1830, and was the first book that was taken, or one of the first books that was taken along with Humboldt and a few other things, like the Bible, with Darwin in 1831 when he went on the Beagle. Now, Lyell stated right up here exactly what the book is about. It's actually published in 3 volumes. This is the first volume. The 3 volumes didn't come out in the same year. This was published in 1830. The second volume came in 31, and I think the third in 33. It was an attempt to explain the former changes of the Earth's surface by reference to causes now in operation. Now in operation. What Lyell said, look, if I go to the Himalayas, or if I go to the Andes, or I go to the Alps, and I find mollusks, fossil mollusks, in these mountains, how did they get there? Now, up until this point, there were many people that thought of very, very interesting hypotheses for how they got there. Volcanoes spewed them out of the ocean and they landed on the mountains millions of years, or at least thousands of years ago. They're not really mollusks, people argue. They're not really mollusks. They look like mollusks, but when the earth was formed, God created the earth such that the crystalline rock was formed to look like a mollusk, but it's not really a mollusk. Those mountains were underwater, and when Noah's floods came, those organisms were really underwater. The floods receded, and there they are exposed. These are some of the arguments in Lyell's time. Lyell said, look, what do I see about me as phenomena that change the face of the earth? I see erosion. I know something about earthquakes. I know about volcanoes. I know about floods. I will explain the processes of geological formations based upon those phenomena that I observe in my lifetime now. This process he called uniformitarianism. And it was an extremely powerful process in all of geological thought. Now, the reason that it became much more powerful than simply in geological thought was it extended to evolution. It extended beyond simply geology. It extended to the life forces which created the Earth as we know it today. Now, we know that uniformitarianism isn't perfect. There's many other processes that interfere in many ways. From simple observations of the Earth today, we can't just simply extrapolate. But the concept is a very powerful one. And Darwin, in fact, was elected to the Royal Society in 1839, not for studies in evolution, but for his contributions to geology. He was so taken with Lyell that he actually worked for most of the early part of his life on geological processes. Now let's take a look at the world in which we live in today. We've described that there is in the sedimentary record areas of extinctions, areas of radiations. That means that organisms have grown out of these extinctions to become larger and larger numbers of species that became again extinct. And that's a continuous process that's been ongoing. Human beings now have changed that. And this is not a great slide, but I think it gives you the figure. Actually, this is an original slide that I got from David Keeling, who is probably one of the most famous biogeochemists of the day from Scripps. And what David Keeling did was he set up an observatory in the remote part of the world in Hawaii, on an island, on the Big Island. And he set up an observatory to very carefully measure the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Very boring. Very, very, very boring. Just keep measuring CO2 every year. And you see CO2 goes up and down with the season, but on a long time scale, it's just the trend is like this. So this is 1958. The end of the record here is in 1988, and we're continuing to go up and up and up. To give you an idea, this is 355 parts per million. We're now at about 370 parts per million by volume in the atmosphere. Well, a lot of time and a lot of effort has gone into looking at climate change. And it's a cottage industry for many, many people around the world. But one of the ways of reconstructing CO2 concentrations in recent geological time, let's say the past few hundred years, has to look at ice cores. If one goes to the Arctic or the Antarctic, you can find areas where you can take a core through an ice formation and find bubbles. Now, you can date the ice. There are a number of ways of doing that. You simply see the seasonal snows. And the gases from each of those years has more or less been trapped intact and representative of that time. And if one goes back into cores, for example, this is from Sipple Station, which is an Antarctic station, I believe, you can go back to the prior to the or around the Industrial Revolution and find that the atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration was on the order of about 270 parts per million. In other words, over the last 200 years or so, human beings have increased the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide by approximately 100 parts per million. Or another way to look at it is by on the order of about 40%. So why should we care? Carbon dioxide absorbs infrared radiation. That means that as the solar radiation that you see with your eye, the visible radiation, comes in to the Earth's surface, the Earth, being a heavenly body, must re-radiate that energy back to space. Otherwise, we would continuously heat up. We don't heat up. But on the way that that radiation is going back out to space, it encounters carbon dioxide molecules in the atmosphere on the way back out. And the carbon dioxide molecules absorb that radiation, and they re-radiate it back to Earth. And it plays this game for a while. Ultimately, the radiation is radiated back to space. We call this the greenhouse effect. It's very nice. It keeps the Earth warm, which would otherwise not be. And it's the second most important greenhouse gas. It's not the first, the second. The first is water vapor. This is the second most important. But it's the one that is affected most dramatically and most directly by human intervention in the last 200 years. And as a consequence of that, with some controversy, but almost without any argument in terms of the observables, we can find that the Earth's temperature has increased on the order of 6 tenths to 7 tenths of a degree centigrade in the last 100 or so years. Now, if we continue to consume carbon dioxide at the present rate, somewhere in the middle of the next century, it is thought that the atmospheric temperature will increase more markedly on the order of a few degrees, perhaps as much as 5 degrees centigrade at high latitudes. This will change dramatically many, many, many things. It could be a boon for Canada. You might have tropical gardens in the middle of Saskatchewan. The tundra might not be permanently frozen. The consequence of this we do not know. But the phenomenon exists. I don't think that there's a large, viable argument that the phenomenon is not due to the increase in atmospheric carbon dioxide. Now, what can we learn about natural cycles? This rather sordid slide is actually an attempt by a colleague of mine to represent the orbit of the sun around the Earth. As the sun goes around the Earth, it can wobble on its axis. It can have a change in the ellipticity, in the rate at which it goes from point A back to point P. It can go slightly off skew, and it can go up and down above this axis. There are three basic kinds of changes in the Earth's orbit that are predictable based upon the astronomical calculations of the imperfections in the orbital variations that we can observe. These have been known for at least 150 years, from Laplace's time. Laplace was a French mathematician around 1875 at the École Polytechnique that discovered the orbital variations to begin with. And around the middle of this century, a rather famous Serbian astronomer mathematician named Milenkovic calculated these orbital variations and their frequency. As he was in prison for 4 years, he had very little else to do, and he had pencil and paper at hand at least, and was able to make these very tedious calculations just simply with pencil and paper, before pocket calculators, which amazes my children. And he found that orbital frequency variations occurred naturally with a periodicity on the order of 20,000 years or so, 40,000 years, and 100,000 years. If one looks then at ice cores, these ice cores, or excuse me, just at cores in sediments, we can find evidence of ice ages that occur with these relative frequencies on the order of 20,000 years, 40,000 years, and 100,000 years. These are due to natural variations of the Earth's orbit around the sun. We are now in a period in the Earth's history which is known as an interglacial period. The last glaciation was on the order of 18,000 years ago, and the glacier extended in the United States, for example, down to a point around where New York is today in the eastern seaboard. I don't know exactly the lowest extent here on the western seaboard. I should know that. If you were, in fact, living in what is Chicago today, at that time, 18,000 years ago, when there were human beings walking around, presumably, on the North American continent, you would have been standing on a block of ice approximately 3 kilometers thick. So within what is clearly a period of human development, there has been vast changes, or there have been vast changes, in the Earth's climate, which we do not have, obviously, a written record for. However, the Earth has also warmed, and that has led to major changes in many things. When those glaciers receded, sea level rose 120 meters. You could have walked to the edge of the continental shelf 18,000 years ago and been on dry land. You cannot obviously do that today. The edge of the continental shelf is approximately 20 miles offshore. As well, of course, the glaciers receded, permitting agricultural development in North America, which would not have been permissible 18,000 years ago. What caused that change? We think it's the orbital variations. That's one possibility, and that is a subscribed to and widely held theory. There are many people that are doubting just simply that theory, that there must have been other phenomena that have been related to the drawdown of atmospheric CO2 that participated in that, and that's an active area of research. Let me just extend this further back in time. And here's where we get into controversy. If we look at the history of the Earth from approximately, on the order of 70 million years ago to present time, there have been large changes on the order of 10 degrees centigrade throughout most of the Earth history. The consequences of this are that we have gone through periods of glaciation and deglaciation, some of which are not easily explained by orbital variations. There have been glacial periods in the last few hundred million years that have lasted for many millions of years, that have no obvious relationship to any known orbital frequency distribution. So we come into other areas, perhaps meteorites hitting the Earth. There are many possible changes that can occur to force this, but not all of these are really understood at all. Now let's just explore briefly what the consequences of these changes in climate have been for life on Earth, and particularly life in the ocean. And I want to get into the concept here of feedbacks, Because you see, the ocean is a major sink for that major gas of CO2. And the phytoplankton keep that gas pressure in equilibrium with the atmosphere lower than it would otherwise be because of their photosynthetic rates. Now, when there are major glaciers that have occurred on Earth, presumably there's less ocean surface area, so there would have been less phytoplankton aerial extent. The oceans would have been colder, they would have been able to absorb more carbon dioxide, but the productivity of the oceans might have changed. When the oceans get warmer, productivity might change. So let's just explore some of these kinds of ways in which we can look at these dynamics or feedbacks. If we change the ocean, does it make the Earth warmer or colder? When we get a warmer world, does the Earth gets warmer for a bit, for example? Is it because the oceans let CO2 out, or did the oceans draw CO2 down to help the Earth get colder again? These are called feedbacks, and there are a number of ways of looking at it. Now, the major way we're going to look at the feedbacks is, again, a representation of the Lyell type of uniformitarianism that I've quoted from the late Evelyn Hutchinson, a Yale, very famous Yale ecologist. And he called this in a very interesting way. He put it, he says, the ecological theater of the present is only an episode in the ongoing evolutionary drama. It means that in order to understand the plot of this drama, if there is one that is perceptible by human beings, one should at least try to look at the ecological theater to derive the inference. Now, the ecological theater today is held in genes in some respects. There is a memory there. The ongoing evolutionary drama is in our proteins, in our bodies. The photosynthetic apparatus, which is what makes that carbon dioxide in the ocean become sugar, is held by conserved proteins, which were evolved billions and billions of years ago. Approximately, as I said, 3.5, actually about 3.7 billion years ago. And it contains what I'll just call simply a motor. We call these reaction centers. There's a power supply, a battery, if you will. It's an antenna. And a drivetrain. And this is an ugly way of looking at it, but there's a motor. There's an antenna around it. Let's see if I can just get to this quickly. This is the motor. There's two proteins that sit next to each other. And these proteins contain a number of metals, for example, manganese and iron, which were very abundant in the Archean Ocean, which are no longer abundant today in the present-day ocean. But yet, this organism, which evolved 3.7 billion years ago, is found today in spinach that you eat, in this manifestation. So this conservation has been there. The power supply, you know, in another way, is simply the green stuff that allows the cells to catch the light. Now, that green stuff is pretty useful. That green stuff is useful because it absorbs the light from the sun. Obviously, that's its intention. But in so doing, it colors the ocean. And you can detect the change in the coloration of the ocean from a satellite. Let me turn everything down. Can I do that? Of the distributions of chlorophyll that are detected, these are now the power supplies, remember? This is the power supply, is a lot of it up here in the North Atlantic, much less of it in the North Pacific. Most of the ocean, which is this light purple, for example, here, maybe it's a little hard to see, is very, very, very impoverished in power supplies. In other words, the phytoplankton distributions in the present-day ocean are very scarce throughout most of the ocean, except near the continental shelves and in the polar seas, and not in all high-latitude seas. The subarctic Pacific is notably less concentrated than the subarctic Atlantic, for example. And our major fisheries and economies of fisheries are keyed to these distributions. Now, the distributions of these organisms is determined primarily by the currents. They cause these gyres in the Earth's surface. And as the gyres turn, where there are major gyres, there's less nutrients, and at the edges of the gyres, there's more nutrients and so-called upwelling, and that's where the phytoplankton are bound to be. Now, I just want to go with you very, very quickly through the health manifestation. I want to take a look at the ecological scene with you and compare it with the evolutionary drama. If we shine a blue light on those power supplies, the cells will glow red. That process is called fluorescence. And in a very simple way, the redder they glow, the happier they are. You can look at it in a simple way. The change in the redness is going to be an indication of their health. So we have a very simple thermometer of phytoplankton health. And we can make toys and tow them around on ships and put them on all kinds of moorings and do all kinds of manipulations in the ocean and look at the health of phytoplankton. How well are they converting that sunlight that they receive into sugar? And if cells are nutrient limited in the ocean, in the gyres, for example, their health relationship we expect from laboratory studies to be low. And if they're not nutrient limited, it gets high. I'm sorry it's backwards, but it doesn't matter again. I'm going from the equator down south towards Tahiti. Not a bad way to go. On a ship, and you can see, here's the health of the ocean. I'm looking at going up and down and up and down, and that's what the ocean does all the time. And these are just little eddies bopping along through the ocean, helping a little nutrients come up, the nutrients go away, nutrients come up, nutrients go away. That's what the ocean does all day long, Central Ocean. But for the most part, it's not a happy ocean. This is a pretty unhealthy ocean. This is 0.2. It should be about 0.6. It's only operating at one-third of what it should be doing. What's happening is, in our modern ocean, in the ocean in which we live today, iron is depleted in many parts of the ocean. It's lost, and it's lost for a simple reason. When the organisms made oxygen, the iron precipitated out of the ocean. And nitrogen, for the most part, is not available. We're living in a world, the ocean world, is nutrient limited. And that nutrient limitation really keeps the ocean from removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. You have a tough time making a living if you're a phytoplankter in today's modern world ocean. Now, I want to do a little bit of a show with you. I brought a movie, and I want to just show you what happens to the health effects of the ocean. In the top panel here, this is just a little box. It's a little box off the islands of the Galapagos, just south of the equator here, where Darwin was, actually, and the last part of his trip, or one of the last parts before he went over to Australia and New Zealand, last part of his trip in Latin America in, I guess it was 1833. This region of the world ocean has a lot of nutrients in it, a lot of nitrogen, a lot of phosphorus. Why aren't the cells doing great? Well, for a long time, we didn't understand that until we did some experiments where we added iron to the ocean. And here's the health effect. This is kind of like the MRI of phytoplankton in the world ocean. This is where it's red, it's great. It's doing great. Now, let me just see if we can play this movie for a second. It's supposed to come up somewhere. Oh, thank you. And I also want to get past the beginning, right? Help. There we go. The experiment we did was called IronX. And we're going to be putting out iron in the ocean. This is a film that was taken by my colleagues, Big New Kolber, in 1993. And was the first major experiment of its kind. Here's the fantail of a ship. That's just fancy lingo for saying the back. And you can see these huge containers. These are huge vats, which we're filling with iron sulfate.
Okay.
And you'll watch this. 750 kilograms of iron sulfate are added to the ocean. And they're just stirred in behind the ship's propellers and mixed in by the ship propellers as the ship moves along through this pipe. There it goes. What I'll do is, as we leave, I'll play the movie for a little bit at the end here. Thanks. Slide. Camera. Action. Hello. I thought I turned it on. Oh, sorry. There you go. Yeah. There we go. Okay, this is our thermometer. Watch, we just laid out the iron here, and we're going back across the ship track with our thermometer of fluorescence, and you can watch the cells just becoming happier and happier. It's like eating a happy meal. Okay? They're just so happy to see that iron. They haven't seen it in a long time. I communicate with them. And you can watch if you just, they get happy, okay? They start to feel a little sad. You add a little more iron. Okay? A little more iron. And finally, it's the end of the show. All right. We just created a little ice age. That type of experiment is a manipulation, which is exactly what happened during glacial periods. This is a core, a sedimentary record, and you can see this is carbon fixation. It's recorded in the sediments. Okay. During the equatorial times, during glacial periods, you have huge amounts of deposition of carbon in sediments, which appear to be, in first order, correlated with the depletion of nutrients. The depletion of nutrients is correlated with the abundance of iron. Iron is delivered in two ways. It's delivered from the atmosphere and delivered from depth. Now, I just want you to understand that iron is the most abundant transition metal on the Earth's crust. It comes all the time as dust from deserts, blown across the Pacific from the Gobi, blown across the Atlantic from the Sahara, blown across the South Atlantic from the Andes and the interior red deserts of South America. It doesn't quite make it to the Pacific North here, to the subarctic Pacific. It doesn't quite make it to the equatorial Pacific around the Galapagos, and it doesn't quite make it in our present world ocean to the Antarctic. But when it does, it appears that it helps to stimulate phytoplankton growth and draws down CO2, which is buried to a large extent in the sediments, and forms the oil which we drain out of the Earth's crust to burn and consume and to change the atmospheric concentration and potentially atmospheric temperature. Now I'm just going to end up very quickly with another way of looking at the ecological scene and the ongoing evolutionary drama. And I like to keep things somewhat simple. I just showed you kind of Babel tech of fluorescence and so on. It's not so easy to make that equipment, and there's a lot of theory that goes into it. But there was a very nice piece of equipment that was made by an Italian Jesuit astrophysicist, as it turns out, who worked for the Vatican in the 1870s. His name was Angelo Secchi. And Professor Secchi developed, or was asked by Signor Calamari, to come on the Adriatic to examine the optical properties for the Italian Navy, in that case, and specifically the Vatican Navy, because there were city-states at the time. The Vatican Navy wanted to understand, for I don't know what reason, the optical properties of the ocean. And Professor Secchi, who was famous in his day, in fact, you can look him up in the Encyclopedia Britannica, they don't even talk about what I'm going to talk about, they talk about his work on astronomy, developed a series of disks, little plates, just like a dinner plate. One was white, one was red, one was yellow, one was green, and you lower it into the ocean. And you watch until it just disappears. Okay? And that became the Secchi depth. The Secchi depth. Very simple. Now, the white disk, approximately a quarter of a meter to a half a meter in diameter, was used as a standard Secchi disk measurement on every major oceanographic expedition that went out from around the middle of, well, the end of the 19th century to present time. And to my horror, the United States Navy, until about 2 years ago, still had Secchi depths classified information. Nobody in their right minds would worry about submarine tracking using Secchi depths anymore, but that's where the American Navy was. Now, the nice thing about Secchi depths is that since we don't have trees in the ocean, we don't have tree rings in the ocean, we don't have any way of recording the memory of what phytoplankton did last week, let alone last year or last century. But we have Secchi depth observations. And the Secchi depth observation can be related critically in a quantitative way to the amount of phytoplankton, the number of those chlorophyll-containing cells in the surface ocean, quantitatively. In fact, the difference between the little equation that you draw from these kind of Secchi depth, this is the Secchi depth thing, versus the amount of chlorophyll, is only 0.5% worse than your best satellite observation algorithms or equations that we have at the moment. So it's not a bad thing. Now, for the North Pacific, we have Secchi depth observations that go back almost 100 years. And they go back almost 100 years, no thanks to the Americans, I might add, but because the Japanese and the French are very meticulous and kept very good records, especially in the Western Pacific. And what I plotted up here is for every 10 by 10 degree grid in the North Pacific Ocean, the Secchi depth and the change in the Secchi depth. So the top number here is the number of observations. You can see in some of these squares, for example, around the Sea of Japan, there are 1,500 observations, and some of them there are only 8. Some of them there are very few. None, for example. This is the American sector. And this is the number of years that are spanned by those observations, 45. And I think the largest number is 74 down here. And all I plotted up for you is in sort of a color. I couldn't do this in color in the publication because it would have cost me a fortune. But and I don't have a fortune, but especially with downsizing. But be that as it may, these little types of squares, this sort of gray, means that the Secchi depth is decreasing. What does that mean? That means there's more chlorophyll there over time. Over the period of the last 50 years, there's been more chlorophyll in these regions and these regions, and less chlorophyll in these regions. Okay? Now, this isn't a random pattern. An oceanographer looking at this sees immediately a coracial current and something like an equatorial current, and the central gyre, which is going around and around like that, is getting less and less chlorophyll over a period of, long period of time. It's not a lot. It's not a lot. But it's statistically significant. Now, the whole Pacific as a whole isn't doing very much. But why is this pattern changing like this? Why does it appear to change like that? Well, we think one possibility is that the winds that are driven by what's called the thermal contrast, the difference in temperature between the continents and the ocean, have changed, and they are known now to have changed over the last 50 or 100 years. As they change, they blow a little bit harder at the edges of the ocean, causing this jar to go a little bit faster like this. And as it goes a little bit faster like that, there's a little more nutrients that are upwelling along the surfaces on the edges, and a little less nutrients in the center. And what we're doing is we're causing a slow feedback here. We're allowing phytoplankton at the edge of the ocean to become a little bit more productive. The center of the ocean is becoming a little less productive. That is against what the glacial cycles would do. So there are two dynamics at play. There are two dynamics at play. They're playing in adding nutrients to the ocean by the addition of iron, for example, the simulation of the glacial periods, drawing down CO2 from the atmosphere, or causing the gyres to spin around faster and faster, which is what would happen at the strongest period of the interglacial time. How these dynamics exactly will play out, we do not know. And that is perhaps one of the most challenging and not just simply academic aspects of dealing with climate change. The prediction of which way these feedbacks will go and understanding their relationships to the geological past and predicting the future and the human intervention therein will probably have the most profound effect on the way human society will function in the next century. This is not something that is happening in vacuo. It's very complicated. Human beings, as they increase in their population, demand more and more food. The food requires the addition of nitrogen to the soil. The nitrogen to the soil finds its way back into the rivers. This is just simply a population, numbers of people, as a function of the amount of nitrogen in the rivers. There's a very, very strong correlation worldwide. We're adding nitrogen to rivers. We're doing something to carbon. It's not very simple. We understand things in the world on short time scales, months, perhaps a year. Understanding things on long time scales is very difficult for us. And politically, it's very difficult for us to make decisions that affect things on those time scales. As I leave you tonight, I don't want you to be alarmed, but I want you to think a little bit. We started out the evening talking about three somewhat apparently disparate subjects of my title: phytoplankton, oil futures, and global change. I think now, perhaps, the end of the talk, those three subjects seem naturally related to each other, I would hope. And yet, we don't really understand fully or appreciate what will be in our own future as we, as a society and as a world, must make decisions about how to continue to survive, thrive, grow, compete, provide food, provide energy, provide shelter, and provide fiber in order for us to live. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Questions?
The back, way in the back. Yeah. There are what is the possibility, or what do I think about potentially adding iron to the ocean to as a remediation effort, in effect? In the United States, the political babble or code word for this type of intervention is called hazard prevention. Okay, it sounds very innocuous. It's kind of like you're stopping a fire or something. It's actually not, even if one could do it, and I'll just give you an aside for a second. When we first started to work on iron limitation in the ocean, one of the major sponsors for iron limitation research was the DuPont Company, you know, bringing good things to life through chemistry. And the reason that the DuPont Company was interested in it was, of course, they manufacture most of the titanium for the world. And in the process of the manufacture of titanium, for every pound, approximately, of titanium that is produced, 2 pounds of iron chloride are manufactured as a byproduct. So every company, every president, every CEO likes to see dollars from a waste stream. And they funded a lot of work into the theoretical application of using or selling, actually, can you believe the chutzpah, selling their byproduct of iron chloride to the U.S. government, for example, to go out and try to draw down CO2. Well, it turns out to do something interesting in models. These are mathematical games, so we don't know exactly what would happen, but I think that they're relatively realistic. And it just shows you the complexity of the situation. If you went out and added iron in large quantities to parts of the world ocean, you would get a large amount of carbon dioxide fixed in that area. But as the particles of phytoplankton and their debris would sink, they would become oxidized, not deep in the ocean, but some middle portion of the ocean, not very deep, actually. And they would consume most of the oxygen very quickly. We see this large areas of the world ocean where this happens naturally. For example, today off the coast of Peru, there's an oxygen. In the process of producing these low oxygen environments, one then produces secondary gases, for example, methane, nitrogen oxides. These gases would then outgas to the atmosphere. Methane has a much greater infrared absorption capacity than CO2. So actually, you have done potentially much more harm than good in your attempt to make things right by adding iron to the ocean. So it's actually, you would have mucked about potentially with an area of the world ocean and made things worse, not better. Needless to say, DuPont stopped funding iron research. Sir.
Since the Second World War, a big number of wrecks of warships lie rusting in the lagoons of Pacific Island.
Yes. Very little in the areas of the, excuse me, what's the effect of things like of warships in that have been left as rotting hulks in areas like wonderful, beautiful coral atolls? The iron is not getting to the parts of the world ocean where it needs to get. So there are only 3 major areas of the world ocean where there's real strong evidence for iron limitation. The Antarctic Ocean, parts of it, the equatorial Pacific, which is very deep at that point, the Antarctic Ocean is very deep, and the subarctic Pacific. And adding iron in the form of, say, sprinkling ground up cars or something, really will have very little effect. You have to add iron in solution, and you have to keep it in the reduced state of Fe2+. Which is difficult to do. And actually, it's an interesting problem, because when you add iron to the ocean, it becomes rust. It oxidizes. Rust, as you probably are aware from your common experience, if you have a rust stain in your sink, you try to get it out by just washing it with soap and water, it doesn't go away. The way you get it to go away is you buy something in the hardware store called Zud or something like this, crud, or you sprinkle it on there. It's oxalic acid. The oxalic acid simultaneously reduces and chelates the iron. It makes it go from Fe3 to Fe2. And that's what's soluble. And in the normal ocean, there's very little Fe2. So the iron has to be delivered in a certain way, and it has to be delivered over very large areas, and it has to be delivered primarily from the surface. Sir?
the slide that was shown some years ago at the Institute, the silent migration.
Yes.
If only there's any correlation between the result of Sherman Hill's slide and work done on silent migration.
Is there any correlation between the distribution of phytoplankton and salmon migration patterns? I'll punt in a sense. And the reason I'll punt is the earliest dreams of fisheries biologists have been to derive a relationship between the distribution of prime producers and the distribution of fish. That dream goes back to the earliest part of the century when Hjort and others developed fisheries biology as a field. To this day, we do not have strong, robust correlations between phytoplankton distributions, for example, their abundance and productivity, and the distributions of fish. It is much more ephemeral than we wished it to be. And there are colleagues in this institute, or in the UBC, for example, who are experts exactly in that. Dr. Tim Parsons, for example. I don't know if Tim is here. But those are the people that really are experts in that, and I think that there's an awful lot of work that goes on to try to derive those areas robust. Peter?
On balance, how concerned are you about the prospects of global warming?
Yeah. The question is, on balance, how concerned am I about global warming? I'm very concerned. And the reason I'm concerned is because of a very simple quote of Roger Revelle, who was the mentor and the person that suggested that David Keeling set up the Mauna Loa Atoll Station. Roger Revelle was a famous physicist at Scripps who died a couple of years ago. And he said the following: human beings have embarked upon the most dramatic experiment that they have ever done as a world, with themselves as the guinea pig. What I'm concerned about is there are many feedbacks. Most of the feedbacks that one models, with few exceptions, are what we call positive feedbacks. In other words, the more carbon dioxide that we add, you get a global warming effect that is greater than one predicts just from the carbon dioxide alone. What I'm really concerned about is that we can model perhaps the temperature change. In climate research, the major, major problem is modeling rainfall. Now, you and I can live in a world that is 2 degrees warmer. No big deal. If there is a dearth of rainfall in areas that are the breadbasket of the world, Canada, the United States, Australia, large portions of Asia, there is tremendous famine that will be felt. And that issue is something that we can debate, we can discuss, but at some point, it is more prudent to take corrective actions sooner rather than later. And what I'm afraid of is politically, this has become a conservative versus liberal game in the United States, which I'm extraordinarily concerned about. One of our most esteemed, well, let's not put it so, one of our most powerful congressmen, Congressman Dan Rohrabacher, who sits on an oversight committee that's very powerful in providing funds for research in these areas, is a very conservative Republican from California, and he called global climate change liberal claptrap. When it becomes this type of game, everybody is potentially hurt, and the intellectual dialogue and discussion ceases. It just becomes irrational debate. And I'm hoping that this type of situation soothes out a bit. And I also would hope that the United States would aggressively move to decrease oil consumption, as Canada obviously has done by increasing the cost of its own fossil fuels. Politically, that's obviously been a big problem in the United States. And secondly, of course, is to decrease, in so doing, it would decrease its foreign trade deficit as well. But there are other countries like China, which consume huge, huge, huge amounts of coal, and their economy for the future is designed by the ministries to be based upon fossil fuel consumption. Until the world finds safe alternative fuel sources, renewable fuel sources, this is going to be just an ever-increasing problem that we will face, and our children's children will face. Wait, back there, sir? Yes. What is the effect of ozone on phytoplankton? I would say that's, to my mind, extremely contentious. You know, as I talked about the evolution of phytoplankton, ozone is and stratospheric ozone levels, as far as we know, a relatively new phenomenon. Ozone didn't exist before there was oxygen, obviously. And when phytoplankton evolved, they evolved in a world with a lot more ultraviolet light than is present now. So in terms of prime production, there are many, many mechanisms that have evolved that protect against higher fluxes of ultraviolet radiation. For higher organisms, that flux could be somewhat significant and is unknown. What I am worried about is that human health effects definitely are related to ozone. Organisms that live in terrestrial environments are exposed to much greater fluxes of ozone than organisms that live in marine environments. And in a human health point of view, this is a cause of increasing numbers of cancers, many of which go long unnoticed, and it's the second largest cause, as far as I know, of death by cancer in the United States, after lung cancer. So I am, to be honest with you, I'm really not that concerned about the ozone hole for phytoplankton productivity. Perhaps there are small changes in species compositions, but I think that's really, really not a big deal that I can see. It's not that big a deal. We've poured more emphasis into that, perhaps, than we should have. Sure. Okay. Sir. What causes the periodic extinction of phytoplankton? There are two reasons that we can correlate with the extinctions. One, as I mentioned earlier, is glaciation. Phytoplankton evolved primarily in oceans that were obviously of a certain thermal regime. When the ocean temperatures have gone below an accepted tolerance for many species, they will die, and they become extinct, as far as we can tell. And we do not see some major classes again ever reappearing in the fossil record. The other phenomenon that occurs is just the opposite way: high elevated temperatures in the ocean. There are times in the ocean when the deep ocean, can you imagine this now? The deep ocean today is on the order of 2 degrees centigrade. I'm talking about deep ocean being at 3,000 meters. There are times or periods in the Earth's history when that deep ocean was 18 degrees centigrade. It was called the hot ocean. It was an anaerobic ocean. So the surface ocean was productive, perhaps, but the deep ocean was anaerobic. And under those conditions, we see also very major extinctions in the fossil record. So we say that primarily the driver of the extinctions was thermal somewhere. What causes the thermal variations is the source of major speculation. I would say, though, that there is another lesson that I didn't discuss today. Nature will tell you, or the lesson you learn from nature is, necessity is the mother of invention. When the ocean is in a bad state, as it is now, for example, the interglacial ocean is nutrient poor, that's when you get many species formed. Species arise out of stress. When the ocean is full of nutrients, when there's a lot of nitrogen, there's a lot of iron around, it's very productive, a lot of carbon is produced, but there are very few species that we find in the sedimentary record. So there's a sort of an up and a down of it. Evolution selects or increases diversity in times of stress, but decreases productivity, at least in the ocean, during those periods. During times when there's less stress physiologically, there are very few species, but higher productivity. Any other questions? Thank you. One. Sir?
Two-part question.
Uh-oh.
Do you think that the human race is likely to become extinct?
Definitely.
What is your personal estimate of the time of
day? Yes. This kind gentleman is asking me to exercise my degree in philosophy. He asked me what my opinion was as to whether the human race will become extinct, and the second part of the question was the time scale, asking me basically, am I an optimist or a pessimist? The first part is, I think, an obvious answer. We will become extinct. I don't think that that's a problem. Personally, I mean, I think that's the natural cycle of such as our species. You see very successful species that have no predators. You become self-limited by resources. You compete with each other. There is basically a perfect model for a chaotic extinction in population dynamics. Mathematically, I mean, that's just the way population dynamics would run. You would just, it's a boom and bust. When? Well, I wouldn't even dare to speculate. I wouldn't dare. But I would certainly hope that intelligence will prevail over irrationality. So if intelligence prevails over irrationality, then our chances of success and survival for extended periods obviously increase.
You are an optimist.
I am an optimist. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
I'll now call on Professor Paul Harrison from the Department of Departments of Oceanography and Botany to thank our speaker.
Well, I'm glad we ended on an optimistic note. It's a pleasure on behalf of the Vancouver Institute and the audience to thank Dr. Falkowski for the wonderful lecture. I'm sure that you agree that he certainly shared some of his excitement for oceanography and his excitement for the research that he actually does. It's important to be reminded, I think, again, that the ocean does cover two-thirds of the surface of the Earth, and yet, as the general public, we really have very little understanding of the ocean. And as Dr. Falkowski has pointed out, the ocean is very important for us in terms of many of our everyday life situations, all the way from the oil futures, where we make our money, or some of us, to tar sands, and then now to the mega problem of the climate change. Two decades ago, when I was a graduate student at the same time as Paul, oceanography was very exciting at that time, and it so sort of co-occurred along with the space age. And so that was the time when we were landing on the moon, and there was also excitement of this inner space, which was oceanography. And that time we were had submersibles, and we were going down to the deepest trenches and just sort of seeing what was there. We've now come beyond that point and now dealing with sort of other interesting problems that we now face. The ocean is very complex, and as Dr. Falkowski has pointed out, it sort of blends physics and the chemistry and the biology and the geology, and so one has to have this sort of mega view then as to how that whole system works. The new challenges that are faced by present-day oceanographers are just as exciting, and are the use of satellites, where the satellites now zoom overhead, and it helps us to tell something about all of the complexities of the ocean, the variability in terms of these engines that he talked about, the chlorophyll and the phytoplankton and their distribution. We have other problems, other challenges with fisheries management. When I have been giving lectures in one of my oceanography classes 10 years ago, we just talked about increasing food resources from the sea, and now we have collapses of fisheries. We just, you know, didn't think that there was some end to it, and we now see that there is some end to it. There are now challenges with red tides and harmful algal blooms, which connects up to the fertilizer coming out of these rivers. So these rivers are big fertilization machines from agricultural runoff and from the nitrous oxides that come from our car, et cetera, and these are causing excess blooms. Not too unlike the situation where you put fertilizer on your garden and you'd hope it would go all into the corn, but in fact the weeds grow also. Well, we have weed species in the ocean, and some of these weed species then have toxins, and they cause toxins for shellfish, et cetera. The production of the ocean from wild catch is, I think, come to pretty much to an end. There isn't anything new. There isn't any new spots. There's no new species left. And if you look back on where agriculture is compared to aquaculture, then these are decades apart. So I think great strides can be made in aquaculture, and so that's, you know, another interesting challenge. But I think the last biggest challenge of all is the one that Paul ended up with, is the global climate change. And the ocean has a real role to play there in terms of understanding the carbon cycle in the ocean, et cetera. So we now have one very large international program that's run by many countries, and that's exactly what they're doing, is going back, looking at the ocean and trying to understand the interplay between the carbon dioxide and in the air and in the surface, and how much is then sedimented out to depth. So again, I would like to thank Dr. Falkowski for that sort of broad overview, and we need many, many excellent speakers like he is to help portray this information to the public in terms of the ocean and how it interacts with our everyday lives and with our land environment that we're so familiar with. So again, thank you very much for a wonderful lecture.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, I guess I should stand back if I'm going to use this. Good evening. My name is John Madden, and I'm president of the Vancouver Institute. This is the welcome to the last lecture of our 79th year in existence. This lecture will end the spring program. Now, I was talking to the two nice people at the desk who will accept your contributions earlier this evening. And one of them said, you know, it's always like this, that people wait until the end of the year, and if they like the lectures, then they make a contribution at the end of the year. So that's a little thought I could leave with you, but actually I can do better than that, because if you sign up now, then your membership will be good for next year. And that'll mean you'll get mailed a program well ahead of time, and all of those good things that go with it. This is my last time as your
president making an introduction. And I think it's only appropriate, first of all, to mention that what I believe has been an outstanding season. And I would like to take all the credit for that, but I cannot. The presidents come and go, but the program chairman, fortunately for us, has a degree of permanence which really allows this institute to work. And I'd like, first of all, to thank Peter Nemeth, who's chairman of the program committee. Peter, would you stand up, just in case those don't know you? And Roseanne Rumley, who makes sure that everything happens on time, and Roseanne is here. And it's appropriate, too, to give our thanks to the University of British Columbia, and especially the Office of Continuing Studies and Community Relations, which makes all this possible for us. I should say that our speaker tonight, as many of you will know, is here as a Cecil and Ida Green visiting professor. He's already given one of his four talks, so he's well run in and oiled up and ready to go. This will be his second tonight, and if you really enjoy tonight's talk, you may then wish to join him again on Monday at 12:30 in Biosciences, where his topic will be the molecular basis of photoacclimation in unicellular algae, and again on Tuesday at 3:30, also in Biosciences, the molecular basis of of iron limitation of phytoplankton photosynthesis in the ocean. Dr. Falkowski was born in 1951 and raised in New York City. He earned his bachelor's and master's degree from the City College of New York and his doctorate here from the University of British Columbia. After a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Rhode Island, he went to the Brookhaven National Laboratories in 1976 to join the staff of the newly formed Oceanographic Sciences Division. He received tenure in 1984 and served as head of the division from 1984.